Welcome to the Florida Roundup 2018 Year in Review. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And that's right, Tom, today we're taking a look back at a very eventful 2018 as we talk about some of the biggest news stories in the state this year. Let's first go back to Valentine's Day. 17 people were killed and 17 more shot when a 19-year-old gunman went to his former high school in Parkland. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School became the site of the deadliest high school shooting in the country. The violence unleashed the voices of Stoneman Douglas students in ways previous school shootings had not.
We see things like Pulse and Sandy Hook and so many other shootings and massacres all over the country that are just let go within a week, and our politicians are really doing nothing at all, and it's sad.
We want people to get out and be politically active. We want people to stand up and say, this is not okay.
We are going to be the kids that you read about in textbooks. Not because we are going to be another statistic about mass shootings in America, but because we are going to be the last mass shooting.
That was just days after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas tragedy. The shooting happened while Florida lawmakers were in session. And within hours of the tragedy, Governor Rick Scott was promising action.
You just hope this never happens again. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure this doesn't happen in our state again. I don't want it to happen in our country again. Next week, I'm going to sit down with state leaders. I'm going to bring people together, and we're going to figure out what we can do to have an impact on school safety and making sure that somebody that has mental illness does not have access to a gun.
The result was the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. It included the first restrictions on gun ownership in Florida in years, but it didn't address assault weapons, the kind of rifle used in the Stoneman Douglas shooting, or the kind of weapon used in the Pulse nightclub massacre that happened in Orlando in 2016.
Now, the law does require more security at public schools, along with mandatory active shooter drills in schools for students and more mental health counseling for kids. We're going to begin the hour with a look back at reflections on the Parkland shooting and how it changed this state as we welcome reporter Katie Switkowski. She's WLRN's Broward County reporter, and also with us Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. And tweet us at Florida Roundup as we talk about the biggest Florida news stories of the year. Katie, let's start with you. You covered the tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas from the beginning. And so when we listen back to the voices of those students saying, we are going to make sure that this is the last mass shooting at a high school in America, that didn't happen, of course. But what did happen is that the kids from Parkland became leaders of a national movement around the issue of gun violence. As that shooting was unfolding, there's no way we could have predicted what a flashpoint it would end up becoming for this country. But take us back to that day and your memories of what happened as we first got word of what was happening at the school.
Oh, man. Well, it was really chaotic. I remember there were, you know, of course, police everywhere trying to corral people. But I was in the same, I was under an interstate close to the school. I'd abandoned my car on the side of the highway, and traffic was so backed up, we all just kind of ran and walked as far as we could get in terms of how close we could get to the school. But I was standing in a group of parents waiting to hear from their children. And so some had strollers, some had brought their younger kids with them, but they had either had not been able to text their children, or, you know, they just hadn't heard or hadn't been able to find where their kids were. And so kids were still fleeing the school, and it was just a mass of people. And I think no one understood in that moment what was happening. And I mean, how could you? But that day, it definitely seemed, from talking to students who were safe and leaving the school and talking to parents, that cell phones were a lifeline for communicating with anyone inside the school. There were rumors circulating. Nothing was clear. But also, there wasn't this idea yet that this activism would come out. There wasn't this anger, because I think it hadn't sunk in at all. And I think I started to see that in the 2 days after the shooting, of how angry people were. And I think that's really what this activism was sparked out of, is this idea that, you know, I mean, true outrage like we had not seen in young people, because this was a group of kids. This was an area of students that said, hey, you know, we have a message, you have to listen to us. There was no belief that they would never be listened to.
Yes, that I think that's really what was so remarkable about this particular high school shooting is the way the difference in the way these students reacted. And as you mentioned, cell phones were a lifeline, but what we saw emerge in the weeks after Parkland was how savvy these students really were in using social media, using the tools of online organizing to tap into what became this ongoing movement that's really gained strength and ended up in a huge march on Washington, which the kids from Parkland led. David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez are two names that come to mind, high school students that became, in effect, celebrities in the wake of this. And so after February happened, and the students rode on buses up to Tallahassee, pushed for legislation, we did see legislation that has changed the way schools approach this issue. How would you rate the effectiveness and the impact of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act? That's the long name for it. The first changes to gun laws in Florida in many years.
Yeah, so now you have to be 21 years old to be able to purchase a firearm. And previously it was 18. And when I look at this act, I think, you know, we're so far later in the year and I've seen so much come out of the Public Safety Commission that it's hard for me. I got to go look back at this law and see how it all started, because I think a lot of people feel like that was a long time ago. But less than a year ago, and the amount that that bill did in less than a year really was the foundation for so many things that either they seem normal now or we have to accept them as our new normal. But the act, in addition to firearms, it also set aside a bunch of money for mental health, allocating more mental health funding for schools. And it did set up these things that we talked about earlier about mandatory drills. One thing I think it also did was it laid the foundation for this Armed Guardians program, the idea that you can have trained armed personnel in schools that, you know, are former law enforcement that take the place of the school resource officer. That's an idea that came from this bill. And so when you look at the amount that it's accomplished in such a small time, I think it has been impactful. But I also think it's important to note that people here in Parkland and in Broward really see that as just a start.
Lynn Hatter, how did that come about? Because as Katie mentioned, it all happened within 6 or 8 weeks after the shooting.
It was a blur.
The shooting happened. The tragedy happened on February 14th. The legislative session was underway. And by April, there was legislation that Governor Rick Scott signed. And by September, school districts across the state had to have armed personnel on campus the first day of school. How did it come about?
It came about really because of those students. You saw them pretty much at the Capitol every day. They had marches at the Capitol. They were on the ground. They were meeting with lawmakers. And you really saw lawmakers on both sides of this issue come together and create this bill. Following what Katie said, you know, you got a bump stock ban also in place. You got a 3-day waiting period on all gun purchases put in place. These were ideas that really Democrats had been floating for years with absolutely no momentum. And now, you know, you see it happening. A lot of these ideas were very bipartisan in nature. And again, it was that student activism that really came out. These students were angry and they came to Tallahassee and they would not leave Tallahassee until lawmakers did something. I think, too, the shocking nature really kind of took lawmakers sort of out of their position of we're going to go with whatever the NRA tells us to go with. You really saw them stepping back and saying, no, we have to do something because we cannot look like, you know, we're immovable on this issue. And so you saw that happen. You got this piece of really significant legislation in it. Democrats got wins. Republicans could look like they were doing something. And all of that came together. It was the right moment, triggered by one of the worst tragedies that the state had ever seen. And keep in mind that this didn't even happen after the Pulse nightclub shooting. Right. So it took the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School to really get these changes in place.
And one of the other things included in this bill was this state commission with this report due January 1st of the new year of 2019, supposed to lay out a roadmap for the legislature going forward. But how important was the creation of this commission in the legislative response to the tragedy, Lynn?
It was very important. And in fact, that commission has been meeting. It even met last week to sort of iron out its final recommendations. You know, after the shooting, now that we've had time to reflect, you know, there were a lot of questions raised about the initial response to the shooting, how law enforcement handled it. There were missteps along the way. And you know, there have been a lot of questions about could this have been prevented? Well, now you have the commission that's been meeting, and it's slowly been sort of rolling out some of its recommendations for how schools in general can sort of avoid these sort of things in the future. And that's going to become sort of a guideline, I think, for school districts to use as they move forward in trying to iron out what their safety plans are. There were a lot of issues. And usually when these situations occur, people do stop and reflect and take a look. And I think with respect to this commission, I would not be surprised if many of the commission's recommendations end up in state law come March when lawmakers come back to Tallahassee and begin meeting.
And Katie, some of the areas of the report that's being issued around school safety in Florida, you know, recommendations that districts expand more in investing in anti-bullying and mental health programs, increasing school security physically, you know, making the schools harder targets, carrying out active shooter drills. Critics of this response have said, including the activist, the student activist from Parkland, that the commission is looking at everything but the key issue that they've been mobilizing about all over the country, easy access to firearms. And so while we've seen change in Florida around how we regulate access to weaponry, it hasn't been enough for these student activists. And so how do you see this issue going forward in Florida? And as you have watched these young people find their voice on this issue, what has that been like for you to cover as a reporter? Because we all remember that day in February, and we're in a different place now at the end of the year. And certainly the students are as well.
And I know, I mean, one of the things for me is if I feel like there was life and reporting before Parkland and life and reporting after Parkland, you know, what can it possibly be like for these March for Our Lives students? And one thing I've got to say is if there's one thing that, you know, was, you know, positive at all or restores faith in humanity, it is the activism of these students, no matter what side they're on, of how they feel like they can talk about this on a bigger scale and make some change. One thing I will say is, you know, talking to those March for Our Lives students now, not seeing any gun control addressed in this commission report, not seeing the state, you know, address gun control on that level yet, I think they're disheartened. I think they're becoming slightly disheartened. They're still going to continue their mission, but it's undeniable when you talk to them that they're disappointed that it's this far after the shooting. And looking at the commission's report, I mean, we know their early recommendations before this official report gets released in January, but it definitely, there were a couple of struggles, right? So the commission put this together in 8 months, which is extremely hard to do. It's 16 chapters. It's a 400-page PDF. And it really tries to look at statewide, right? So when you're looking at Broward County and Miami-Dade, South Florida, we are big urban schools. But, you know, for more rural schools, how can we implement some of these same safety techniques? And it made a lot of the advocates here of hardening schools very happy. I think, you know, to see the regulations about fences, single entry point, locking doors, and changing how schools look and how you can enter them made a lot of people who are not in favor of gun control, you know, feel like that was the solution. I think gun control is not off the table for the commission because they are still going to continue to meet after this report gets released for a few years. And certainly, you know, some members of the commission have suggested bringing that up. Some victims have suggested bringing that up, victims' families. And I think that that's something we could see them talk about down the road.
A lot of the report does focus on hardening schools.
Yeah.
Even talks about arming teachers potentially, the having teachers have potential access to, you know, first aid supplies, even
stop the bleed training.
Stop the bleed training, those kinds of things. But Lynn Hatter, I want to go back in late February, I think it was, when the legislature decided not to debate an assault weapons ban. And that reaction, you remember the reaction of this Parkland students and parents and others that were in the gallery of the State House reacting with such emotion. So back to this gun control issue here, talking about the legislative response focused on hardening money for mental health. Victim advocates and others will be supportive of that. But is the legislature going to be in a place with a new governor, a new administration and some new members to actively and purposefully tackle or consider further gun legislation?
The short answer is no. You know, it's not politically tenable and an outright ban on assault weapons here in Florida. The Republican Party has held power for the past 20 years. The NRA is still incredibly powerful within this state. And, you know, a lot of lawmakers just don't see that as an issue that they can run on. Democrats do, but not Republicans. And so, you know, even getting the 3-day waiting period on gun purchases was a struggle. The NRA sued over that. So, you know, take that out to an all-out ban on assault weapons, the Florida Republican Party would have an extremely hard time defending that action. You know, there is only so much that the party can do without losing a significant amount of its base of supporters. So, you know, there... Parkland allowed for, I think, Republicans to take a few steps in a certain direction. They could step out, but they could only step out so far. And so, you know, an outright ban on assault weapons, highly unlikely in this state. Now when that happened, you know, the families were crushed. The students were crying. I remember that. Democrats were upset, but there is the political reality that the lawmakers themselves have to deal with. And that, unfortunately, you know, it plays a role. Mm-hmm. It is a consideration because if they want to be here 2 years from now in the House or 4 years, you know, from now, if they're in the Senate, they make these calculations, and that was part of the calculation, especially heading into 2018, which was a major election year.
Certainly. The politics of it have been riveting to watch unfold in this state and how it has affected the issue nationally. As you said, Katie, the students became the faces of the national March for Our Lives movement and continue to be active across the country, barnstorming the country on this issue, giving speeches, very active on social media. I'm sure we'll see at least a few of them run for office at some point themselves. They've called themselves reluctant activists. They didn't want to be in this position, but they certainly are known for it now. And so thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts here on our special year in review episode of the Florida Roundup as we look back at the tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, the shooting in Parkland that killed 17 people, and how it has changed this state. Thank you so much, Katie Switalski. She's the Broward County reporter for WLRN, and Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. So appreciate your insights, and we're going to keep talking. So thanks, ladies, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And much more still to come. More politics, environmental talk, the red tide, the green algae, and more next here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. As we take a look back at the biggest stories of the year around the state, I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks again for listening. So the 2018 election here in Florida will be remembered as much for the recount as it will for the results, right? I mean, yeah. You know, a few of these races too close to call on election night, even several days afterward. It all triggered a state-required recount, including the governor's race and the race for U.S. Senate. Now, that Senate race pitted two-term Democratic Senator Bill Nelson against Governor Rick Scott. The night after election night, Governor Scott stepped out onto the porch of the governor's mansion in Tallahassee.
The people of Florida deserve fairness and transparency, and the supervisors are failing to give it to us. Every Floridian should be concerned there may be rampant fraud happening in Palm Beach and Broward counties.
Of course, no fraud was ever proven. Still, though, lots of criticism about how long the count took. Three statewide races went into an automatic machine recount, and there was trouble in South Florida. Vote counting machines in Palm Beach County broke down, and they could only recount one race at a time. In Broward County, there were delays in counting the absentee ballots. Lots of questions over provisional ballots. Just struggles to recount votes in several races. Then on November 18th, after missing a previous recount deadline by literally 2 minutes, Broward County's director for election planning and development announced that they had finished the official recount 52 minutes before the state deadline.
The results have been transmitted to Tallahassee, and they have received our results and have accepted them.
They have acknowledged receipt.
Round of applause there. A couple of weeks after Election Day, Republican Ron DeSantis, eventually the winner of the governor's office, Governor Scott unseated Bill Nelson in the U.S. Senate, and the first Democrat to be elected in the state cabinet in 12 years, Nikki Fried, will become the agriculture commissioner in the state of Florida in the new year. So let's talk about 2018 year in review. Send us your thoughts on Twitter. At Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. Lynn Hatter, the news director at WFSU in Tallahassee, is still with us. Steve Newborn, the assistant news director in Tampa with our sister station there, WUSF. Julie Glenn heads up the news shop in Fort Myers at WGCU. Great to have everybody back here on the roundup. And let's begin in Tallahassee because this is ultimately where the voting results had to be certified. How did the voting recount reforms that were put in place after the 2000 election perform this year, specifically the automatic recounts and those really quick deadlines that happened just within a matter of a few days of Election Day?
Well, the automatic recount part of it seemed to go well. Everybody who fell between half a percentage point, that's how we ended up with three recounts in the governor's race, the agriculture commissioner race, and, you know, in the U.S. Senate race. But the deadline part of it went terribly. And as you've just heard, the issues happening in Broward, the issues happening in Palm Beach, those deadlines were essentially truncated. You had basically only about a week to try and recount three races, and a lot of the larger counties just couldn't make that happen. You had problems, again, in Palm Beach, where its equipment was and is outdated. It could only count one race at a time. You had problems in Broward with respect to that race, where they had a language issue that really kind of messed up their recounting process. And then I think in Hillsborough at one point when they did a recount, they actually came out with fewer voters. Mm-hmm. You saw their their supervisor just saying, you know what, we're just going to stick with what we had in the beginning right. because this is a train wreck. And so now there have been a lot of questions about how do we make the recount process more efficient. And in fact, that's one of the things that local supervisors of elections have been saying, that they would actually like more time to conduct recounts. In fact, they point to states like California, which can take up to about a month to fully complete a recount. And they're like, there's nothing wrong with that. We would rather get it right than to, you know, get it wrong. And in the case of Nikki Fried, election night, she had actually lost, according to those preliminary returns. It had actually gone to Matt Caldwell. And you saw that as the recount took place, she quickly began to gain on Caldwell and ultimately ended up with about a 6,000 votes ahead of him. So I think that you're going to see some reconsideration of the deadlines, especially with respect to when mail-in ballots come in. We'll probably talk about that a little later, and how long it takes to turn these things around.
Yeah. Steve Newborn, what about that? If this election taught us nothing, it was a reminder to people in the media and political pundits, anyone involved in this, to not be so quick to call an election, because counting every ballot in a really closely divided state like Florida takes time. And certainly there is plenty of well-deserved criticism for several players in the counting of the ballots back in November. But it really was extraordinary to watch this process play out and see yet another recount in this state, both for the governor's race and the Senate race. Seeing Governor Scott stand on the steps of the governor's mansion and, you know, demand an investigation into an election that he himself had a personal stake in. You know, of course, Governor Scott went on to the U.S. Senate. But as you covered this, the Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson, as you look back on it, what stands out in your mind about the unique nature of this contest and how we saw it play out?
Right. It was the end of the road for Bill Nelson, who's been in Congress and working in state government since 1972. Long career, came to an end. And he really was up against his toughest competition ever. Rick Scott is, he's kind of notorious for being focused, relentless. This is a guy who does not hesitate to rush into the scene of a hurricane with his blue Navy cap and take command. And at one point in time, he was getting Rick Scott was getting battered for the whole blue-green algae coming out of Lake Okeechobee and the red tide affecting both coastlines simultaneously. And it just so happens at the height of this, when he was starting to get hounded on the campaign trail by protesters, Hurricane Michael blew through, and he suspended his campaign and focused on the rebuilding efforts up there. And this had two effects, basically. It reinforced his image as somebody in command, right, with the blue Navy cap and being there on the scene. And at the same time, it also gave him an excuse, my words, for not having to be on the campaign trail in places like his native Southwest Florida. Not native, that's where he lives. And not have to face the protesters. So I think that was a big factor in the end. It kind of deflected any criticism about the environmental aspects of this whole race.
We're going to dig a little bit more into the environmental aspects in a second. But Julie Glenn at WGCU in Fort Myers, what strikes you about the 2018 election cycle in Southwest Florida, a reliable and traditional Republican stronghold in this state, where we saw, you know, the governor elected by a very thin margin, and of course the Senate, Governor Scott going to the Senate with an incredibly thin margin.
You know, I find it really interesting what Melissa was talking about earlier about being cautious whether or not to actually call a race. We found ourselves that evening in November having to be very careful because we had candidates that were coming out making their victory speeches when the race had actually not been technically called. They were kind of calling it themselves. They said, well, we're within 1 point, so we're going to go ahead and call it. Well, for example, Matt Caldwell, he did that a little after 10 o'clock at night, and people were not finished, you know, tallying things at that point. And I think that made it even worse in the end by people coming out and calling it for themselves or calling it and saying, hey, it's a done deal. Because then having to go back and do a recount, it's even more embarrassing, you know, because there wasn't an official calling of these, some of these races that were just that close. You know what I mean?
Well,
calling them early.
Oh, sure. Yeah, calling them early, definitely being revisited. And let's talk for a minute, too, about the political environment over this year. It included the actual environment in Florida, thanks to the blue-green algae and red tide that plagued the state for much of the year. The algae returning late this summer after massive releases of polluted Lake Okeechobee water into the Gulf and into the Atlantic Ocean. And it fed an algae outbreak for the second summer in the past 3 years. Adam Weinstein lives along a canal in Fort Lauderdale, and he saw the blue-green algae in the water in September.
On the top, it looks like a bit of an oil slick, but it's, you know, particulate. It doesn't stink too much here yet, thank goodness. I've seen fewer live iguanas and more dead floating ones. As a father and a homeowner and a longtime Floridian, I would really like somebody to be focused on a long-term fix.
So that was the blue-green algae. The red tide, meantime, spread up and down the Gulf Coast of Florida. This is a naturally occurring algae, but the outbreak this year. It was the worst seen in at least 12 years. Tourist Carl Baer was visiting Holmes Beach on Anna Marie Island in August, just days after thousands of dead fish and other marine life washed up on shore, killed by that red tide.
The one day it looked like blood was rolling up on the waves. We saw dead fish, thousands. Can't count them. It's just so bad. And eels and all kinds of different size of fishes.
Julie Glenn with WGCU is in Fort Myers with us here on the Florida Roundup Year in Review, and Steve Newborn with WUSF in Tampa. Both of you experienced this red tide. Julie, you were at ground zero for it. First of all, here at the end of the year, is the red tide still sticking around?
It's persistent. It never did go away. It's well into over a year. So I think it would have been a year last summer. So now it's about a year and a half now we've had this red tide. It comes and goes. We've had the most recent thing that we've had in our area has been on Marco Island with terns, sandwich and common terns falling out of the sky and dying within just moments of landing in the water or on the beach.
What's causing that?
Wow.
And preliminary reports out of the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission say that it is a red tide that was a factor in these, although not completely the cause. They haven't completely determined that. It was suspected, but they weren't sure because, you know, these birds were acting differently than other breeds of birds do when they're impacted by the red tide. They suspect that they may have gotten it a little bit further off the coast as opposed to right up on the shores and then, flown in with the flocks as they're migrating. So there's that. We also had just about a month ago, 42 dolphins wash up from red tide, deceased from red tide. Along the Collier County beaches. So it's still an issue. And that was one of the, I mean, we're talking about politics and that hit, and it really got to the pinnacle in August, July, August, and into September. But it was just enough time for this part of the state, which is pretty deeply red, to develop a little bit of amnesia or distance from it and make it a little bit less of an issue. The environment.
Interesting.
I mean, it was a big issue all year long, but it was just a little bit of short-term memory loss there.
Memory loss. And Lynn Hatter, what about that? Because you saw activists dogging Rick Scott's steps all over the state for months, calling him Red Tide Rick, blaming him for this environmental disaster. The campaign of Andrew Gillum tried to make it an issue as well against Ron DeSantis. But in the end, this issue of red tide and blue-green algae did not hold sway with the voters for the Democrats that tried so hard to assign the blame to the Republican Party, who's controlled the agenda on environmental policies for so long in this state. Why do you think the Democratic candidates were unsuccessful? As Julie said, part of it may have been short-term memory loss. What else was at play?
Well, there were a couple of things at play with respect to the Democratic primary itself. I don't think it became sort of a big tentpole issue within the Democratic primary. That was one of the things. And then, Hurricane Michael came through and sort of blew away the red tide issue. Another thing that you also saw come into play is that Congressman DeSantis, now Governor-elect DeSantis, really worked to kind of separate himself from Governor Scott. In fact, he got, an endorsement by the Everglades Foundation. They endorsed, DeSantis for this issue. So, you saw a couple of things at work. Other issues sort of jumped ahead of red tide. The red tide issue was really sort of centered around that I-10 corridor and down. But in North Florida had other problems. And so the governor was able to pivot very quickly away from red tide. Hurricane Michael came through. That became his focus. Another thing is that, Bill Nelson sort of never really got a lot of momentum. Every time he sort of tried to attack Rick Scott, it sort of rolled off of the governor, like water
from an
otter.
It really
didn't
stick.
He couldn't make it stick. Yeah. And, Scott's messaging against Nelson, if you go back and listen to it, it was really interesting. He was saying, you know, oh, the senator is confused.
Yeah.
He has been around way too long.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
He doesn't know what
trying
he's talking about.
Trying to paint him as out of touch and old.
Out
yeah.
of touch,
yeah.
old.
You know, I think Bill Nelson wound up being kind of the second Democrat. He wasn't the top Democrat on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, you would think the statewide Democratic officer that's been holding that seat for 12 years would be the top Democrat. Instead, it was really Andrew Gillum running for governor. So Steve Newborn, how about in the governor's race, the environmental issue really was, I think, consumed by the Republicans quickly. Ron DeSantis, in terms of his kind of position papers, the first one that he came out with was not on health care, not on education, not on taxes or economic development, normal stronghold Republican issues, but it was on the environment, Steve.
Right. I think he's trying to get ahead of the issue here. He came out very quickly in favor of construction of a new reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, where all the blue-green algae is entering the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers going to the coast. And he also has pledged to form a task force to look at the causes of red tide. Looking at septic tanks is going to be one of these issues. And it's not hard for him to differentiate himself from Governor Scott, whose record on the environment was pretty cloudy as some of the water out there. I mean, this is a guy who basically banned the use of the word climate change.
Yep.
And he eviscerated the budgets of the water management districts that are responsible for monitoring the water that goes into Lake Okeechobee. So I think he was really smart and got ahead of this right off the bat.
He really did. But as you said, it's remarkable how he was able to navigate his way through what I think is fair to say was not a stellar environmental record and keep this issue from sticking to him. At the same time, as we look ahead to a Ron DeSantis administration, Julie Glenn and Lynn Hatter, he has campaigned on being more of an environmental advocate than perhaps his predecessor, Rick Scott.
Yeah,
so
he likes
in the short
to,
time we have left, it'll be interesting to see what he does with this issue.
He likes to call himself
yeah.
a conservationist. That's his catchphrase. He likes to say conservationist, and he likes to stick up for the environment in the name of business, because tourism is a big business in our state, and it's vital that the environment be clean and inviting for tourists to want to come here. So that was what he really campaigned on. So that's kind of how he twisted that environmental issue into his conservationist.
Into his favor. Well, Lynn Hatter of WFSU, Steve Newborn, WUSF, Julie Glenn of WGCU, thanks for sharing your thoughts about this important story from the year. Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Thank you.
And more to come as we look back at 2018 here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Keep listening.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. It's our year in review, a look back at 2018 in the Sunshine State. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And let's go back to October. Over just 2 days that month, Hurricane Michael blew in, swelling to a major Category 4 storm as it raced up the Gulf of Mexico. Michael slammed into the panhandle near Panama City with 155-mile-an-hour winds and storm surges up to 15 feet. It wiped out entire neighborhoods and crippled the region of the state.
Hurricane Michael is moving through very warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico today with temperatures near 84 degrees. The storm is expected to make landfall Wednesday afternoon as a major hurricane along the Florida Panhandle.
This morning, Florida's Gulf Coast, Panhandle, and Big Bend are waking up to unimaginable destruction.
There was limbs falling everywhere, and it scared me for a second.
Homes and businesses that literally appeared to have exploded from the impact from the wind.
It took us 5 days to dig ourselves out to get a vehicle through the trees that was there.
The people we're feeding, they don't have the dollars to go to those stores and buy food right now. They're broke. I mean, lost everything.
Tweet us at Florida Roundup with your memories of Hurricane Michael. Joining us now with more about Michael's impact on the Panhandle, we welcome Jessica Foster of WJHG News. That's the NBC affiliate in Panama City. Lynn Hatter of WFSU still with us here on the show. And Jessica, let's begin with you. As Michael drew closer to the shore of the Panhandle, we had indications from meteorologists that it was going to be a devastating storm. But still, is it fair to say it took the Panhandle by surprise somewhat, just how horrible and how widespread the damage was?
I would say that that is accurate, that it did take the Panhandle by surprise. I think one thing that most residents were focused on was the storm surge impact. And we did have quite an impact in Mexico Beach from the storm surge. But I think what caught everyone off guard was the impact of the winds. The winds for Michael were just ferocious. And if you look at the damage, the widespread damage, it looks like just one massive tornado came through the area.
Jessica, describe the area today. What, two and a half months after the storm?
It's better. And I say that it's better, but I need to preface that with the damage was so extensive that someone that didn't see it right after the storm would be like, whoa, this is incredible damage. So we still have a long way to go. And that's what we're hearing a lot from people is, please don't forget about us. We just want the nation not to forget that we still have quite a recovery ahead of us.
Right. Still lots of people living in tent cities in the Panhandle, still people without electricity months after the storm, even though FEMA's on the ground there. Lynn Hatter with WFSU, how would you assess the state's response to Michael, and how worried should we be as we're looking at a future with warming oceans surrounding Florida? More and bigger storms are predicted. Most climate scientists agree on that. And so as we look at the aftermath of Michael, it's not a positive trend line that we're looking at as we rate and assess the impact of that storm and the response to it.
In fact, there have been more and more conversations about increasing building codes, especially, you know, in the area. We call it the Forgotten Coast. It's called that for a reason. These were historically small communities. Many of them were rural. A lot of them were poor. And, you know, part of the devastation is the impact that it has had on many of these tiny little communities. Panama City sustained pretty much a direct hit, but even smaller communities, Mariana, Bluntstown, places that people, even people, longtime residents in Florida have probably never even heard, you know, of these places, have really been crippled, and they didn't have much to start with, which has really challenged the recovery effort going forward. I think, you know, as far as the state's response, I think if you talk to people on the ground, it has left much to be desired. There are a lot of activists, especially on the ground in Panama City, saying, hey, FEMA, you guys promised us trailers. Where are they? You know, there are still people without homes. With respect to the tent city, one was recently bulldozed that was behind a church, and there have been a lot of questions as to who may have been living in those areas. The housing issue is fairly severe. I think at one point, and Jessica can fact check me on this, the mayor of Panama City even suggested that up to 40% of the building inventory had been destroyed. So that is damage on a scale that this was North Florida's Hurricane Andrew. Yeah. If I were to draw a comparison, and the fact that the storm swept so far inland, even into South Georgia, not only did it move fast, I remember waking up at 2 a.m. the day that the storm hit, and all of a sudden it had gone from a Category 3 to now a Category 4. One of the questions was, well, why didn't people evacuate? Well, I think most people would see a Category 3 and in typical Florida fashion, saying, okay, we can ride it out. By the time they woke up at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, it was pretty much too late for them to evacuate. So you're talking about a storm that this particular area, which really wasn't suited to be able to sustain, that's what it got hit with.
You know, when you talk about the analogy to Hurricane Andrew in South Florida, there was a a famous plea, a cry for help in the days afterward by a resident in Homestead saying, where's the cavalry? Send the cavalry. Mm-hmm. Jessica Foster, I'm wondering, you know, did the cavalry come? Did FEMA show up? Did the state show up? Are they still on the ground now at the scale and the volume that those communities still need?
You know, I would have to say that they did show up. But what issue that we're dealing with now, when we go back to the housing, one of the issues was, okay, we bring the FEMA trailers. They didn't even know where to put the FEMA trailers. Mm-hmm. Because there are certain regulations. We can't put them in a flood zone. And so we had to find land to even be able to put FEMA trailers on. So this is the extent that we're talking about. The landscape has completely changed. The way of life has completely changed. And it's really just a new way of looking at things. And going back to why didn't people evacuate, I think one thing that we need to talk about is that a lot of people did evacuate from the coastline. And they evacuated to areas that they would normally go to when there's a hurricane. They would go to these inland areas more north into Jackson County. But those areas got hit too with this storm because of the ferocious winds.
And Jessica, certainly the worst storm to hit the panhandle in modern history and so late in the hurricane season. Just much warmer ocean water later in the year, fueling these storms and in a place where we hadn't expected to see it strike. And so that element of surprise was part of the issue. But also climate change is a factor in this. What kind of conversations, may I ask, are people in the panhandle having about resiliency and sustainability? And as Lynn touched on, maybe changing building codes in the coastal areas as a response to Hurricane Michael. Has it sparked any kind of real policy change in this part of the state?
It has not sparked policy change at this point because I think everyone is still really in the recovery stage. But there is a sense of community where they're saying we're going to build back and we are going to build back stronger. There's even a hashtag, 850 strong, panhandle strong. Something that actually came up this week as people are starting to rebuild their homes is there is a National Flood Insurance Program regulation under FEMA where some people may need to rebuild their homes to meet the same standards as new structures are required, but maybe their insurance companies haven't given them enough money yet to do that. So those are dealing with damage costing more than 50% of the home's market value. So now our local officials are trying to get that word out. Say, hey, you may not be able to get permitting if you don't realize these regulations. So that's just a whole other factor. And if the home's in a flood zone, they're going to have to follow that guideline and then also elevate their property.
Yeah, they build above the base flood level. Lynn Hatter, this is where state regulations perhaps come in. Moving into the 2019 legislative session, you began the conversation talking about the building code issues that this storm has brought to light and the lack of real strong building codes along the panhandle. The response after Hurricane Andrew in South Florida was some of the strongest building codes in the nation. Is there an appetite for the same kind of regulation in the panhandle in an area that, you know, is lower income, doesn't have necessarily the financial resources in a state that it's already expensive to live in everywhere?
It's going to be hard because you're going to run into situations where people just simply can't afford to build their homes. And we're talking in an area that, you know, property prices are far less than even South Florida, but average incomes are also contingent on things like agriculture. So there's really a tightrope that local governments are going to have to walk. As Jessica raised the FEMA issue, you know, there's also the problem where people may have been underinsured. Some people didn't have flood insurance. Those homes may be gone forever. And so people are still trying to sort of sort this out. In fact, I was looking on OIR's website, I think,
the
in
Office
Bay
of
County,
Insurance Regulation.
the Office of Insurance Regulation, they have a running tally as to residential and commercial claims and what's still open and what's been closed. I mean, in some areas, you know, you still got 40% of open claims, which means people still trying to sort out their insurance issues.
Just
and those are major.
Incredible. Just a long way to go in the panhandle. So I'm glad we could devote some of this end of the year programming to looking at Hurricane Michael. Consider donating to a charity that supports the panhandle. Thanks to Jessica Foster of WJHG News in Panama City and Lynn Hatter of WFSU. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Bridget O'Brien, Alexander Gonzalez, and Heather Schatz, our producers.
Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations in Miami is Peter Maritz. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great holiday.